Well, that went quick. November's over, here comes December. And with 30 or some odd days until the end of the year, and with Christmas and Hanukkah rapidly coming upon us, before you know it, you know, where the heck did 2022 go? And it seems the older I get, the more I appreciate how time truly does fly. And to make the most of what time you've got, I guess our parents and grandparents were right all along, again. Hey, Nick DeOlius here. Good to be with you this time with episode 80 of the Far Middle Podcast. And who are we going to dedicate episode 80 to? I tried really hard to pick just one, but as hard as I tried, I have to go with a co-dedication for episode 80. Because first, how can I pass up the 1980 men's Olympic U.S. hockey team? I just can't. Al Michaels with Do You Believe in Miracles, Mike Ruzioni, Badger Bob Johnson is the coach, beating the Russians, Lake Placid, just epic and magical. It almost speaks for itself. But the second dedication, co-dedication for episode 80, I want to spend a little more time on because this individual completes a triangle or a triumvirate, so to speak, who I consider to be the three greatest football players in the history of the National Football League. So a little bit of Far Middle history for you constant listeners. You go way back to episode 32 of the Far Middle. We dedicated that episode to the greatest all-around football player of all time. That is, of course, the great Jim Brown. Then, a little while ago, for episode 56, we dedicated that episode to the greatest defensive player of all time, who is Lawrence Taylor, or LT. Now, for 80, we get to complete that triangle and dedicate the episode to the greatest offensive player in the history of the National Football League, which is the incomparable Jerry Rice. Now, the greatness of Jerry Rice, and when it comes to his offensive abilities, they jump out at you by statistics, the data show it. He led the league in touchdowns and yardage for receivers four times. How about this statistic? In 1987, Jerry Rice set a season record for receiving touchdowns at 22. But amazingly, he achieved that accomplishment by playing in a strike-shortened season of only 12 games. Makes you wonder what the record would have been if he had the full 16 games to compete. And when you look at his career totals, there's no one that even comes close. He's got the career records for receiving yards and for receiving touchdowns, and he holds both by very wide margins. Next closest to him for receiving yards is Larry Fitzgerald, but he's a distant second. And the closest on touchdowns for career is Randy Moss, but he's also a distant second. Yeah, the data certainly supports the case for Rice's greatness. But one of the other aspects of greatness, right, it's the ability to make those around you in a team sport even better than they would have been without you. And Jerry Rice excelled in that arena as well. There's two quarterbacks that you might have heard of before that Jerry Rice just helped elevate and basically created really easy pathways for their enshrinement in Canton, Ohio. First one is Joe Montana, who hails from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the suburbs of Pittsburgh, of course. And the second is Steve Young, who followed in Montana's footsteps with the 49ers, and he developed just as close of a working relationship with Rice on the field that Montana enjoyed. But you know, the least known of Jerry Rice's accomplishments as a football player are actually the most interesting to me. They occurred during his college playing days at, where did Jerry Rice play college at? Not a lot of people know this, Mississippi Valley State. And at Mississippi Valley State, Rice was under the tutelage of a true offensive innovator, Coach Archie Cooley. And Coach Cooley and other coaches that innovated like him, such as Mike Leach with the air raid offense and Lavelle Edwards at BYU, who, by the way, that's the same BYU where Steve Young was a quarterback in college. They were the unsung innovators of things like the spread offense in the 1980s. And Coach Cooley was front and center with respect to that. He used a wide open, no huddle, five wide receiver attack that was basically, it couldn't be matched. It couldn't be met by a defense for a number of years, almost coming up on a decade. And Coach Cooley did all this with a recruiting budget at the time of $3,500 a year. And for years, he was averaging over 50 points a game. They did it with a no huddle and with throwing over 50 passes, sometimes over 55 passes a game. And using that type of an offense, Mississippi Valley State, they broke virtually every NCAA Division I AA passing record. Willie Totten was the quarterback, but on the receiving end of those passes, roughly 300 of them, was our dedication for 80 Jerry Rice. So I love stories of innovation, whether it's in business or in research technology, but also in sports. Jerry Rice has the stats, he's got the awards, and he's got the history of making teammates better, but he has that added element of innovator. Episode 80 goes to Jerry Rice and the 1980 men's U.S. Olympic hockey team. Well, that theme of innovation, whether it's Jerry Rice on a football field or in business or in technological research and advancements, it jumpstarts episode 80, where we make connections to issues or dots, again, in perpetual homage to the great BBC legend, Dr. James Burke, and his awe-inspiring series Connections. Love that guy, and I love that series. Innovation represents a number of things, right? It represents human ingenuity. It represents step change improvement from the status quo. It represents what was once underutilized or non-utilized and converting it into a thing of great value. And it represents disruption, creating new avenues to improve quality of life, to advance the state of the art, and to further improve the human condition. And innovation equates to growth and to advancement and to improvement, which means the antithesis of innovation are those opposites. It's not growth, it's degrowth. It's not advancement, it's regression. And it's not improvement, it's degradation. And unfortunately, we have seen time and time again where government and state intervention and the policies that represent those things, they're designed intentionally or unintentionally to result in the opposite of innovation. That's nothing new to the Western world when it comes to government and elites and their policies. And an example from the late 1960s that bled into the 70s and even into the 80s was the often celebrated, but in hindsight, completely inept and destructive views of the Club of Rome. Now, I'm not sure which Constant listeners out there are familiar with the Club of Rome. It's a fascinating organization, and its history is stacked with examples of what not to do when it comes to listening to the prescriptions of the elites and the policy machinations of proponents of state intervention. It's so fascinating, or at least I find it to be so fascinating, that I plan on writing a commentary on the subject, The Club of Rome, soon, and posting it on nickdeolius.com. So I'll let you know when I do that and look for it soon. I think you'll find it interesting. But until then, right, suffice to say, the Club of Rome was an elitist organization that was focused on degrowth or no growth. In fact, its most well-known work product was the flawed treatise, The Limits to Growth. And I'm not sure if this is the case in 2022, but for a number of years, The Limits to Growth, it was the best-selling environmental book in history, something like over 30 million copies sold in dozens of languages worldwide. So it was really influential. And The Limits to Growth and the Club of Rome in general, they proved to be the genesis of a host of beliefs and concepts and ideologies that run rampant today in modern society. So the club, which included elites from the arenas of government and think tanks and academia, they wanted and they were looking to undermine and attack core tenets of the Western world, such as capitalism and industrialization and the free market and the harnessing and utilization of natural resources. They didn't like those things. And the way the Club of Rome attacked those things, and tell me if this sounds familiar, because it should, it was to develop what was warranted as a highly technical series or cluster of computer models and programs, but ones that ran or did their thing within an opaque black box structure that defied the ability to assess or to audit the assumptions and the calculations and the results. And these models were either used to predict or ended up predicting as outputs all kinds of various calamities and chaos that would prevail upon the globe within a relatively short period of time, unless growth and innovation were de-emphasized. So what types of calamities and chaos? Well, you know, the usual predictions that never seem to have gone away since the founding of the Club of Rome in the late 1960s, despite such predictions being proved to be absolutely false and wrong. You know them well by now, right? Global starvation when population expansion can't be supported with agricultural or crop yield practices. Natural resources running out as consumption grows with economic growth, financial panics and collapses. Peak oil was another one, right, where we run out of oil, but not before the price of it goes through the roof. And climate change, which, yes, reared its head way back then, as well as exhaustion of things like water resources. And then, you know, this theme of excessive consumption that leads to depletion of both the environment as well as the quality of life. And the key conclusion from the Club of Rome and the Limits to Growth and the computer modeling was that unless things drastically changed when it came to consumption and capitalism and population, then the world was going to collapse, or society was going to collapse within the next 100 years. So here we see in the late 1960s and the 70s, the first of these series of predictions, where elites gather in some sort of confab, like the Club of Rome back in the day. They run these opaque computer models to create that veneer of sophistication, but yet the models are black boxes that lack transparency to be able to question or assess or audit. And then they make these wild predictions that can't be proven or tested because the predictions are not claimed to occur within the near term, but instead over the course of decades, or in this case, when it comes to the limits to growth, over the course of a century. And again, does any of that sound familiar today, constant listeners? You know, Mark Twain said something about history not repeating itself, but rhyming. Well, with all due respect to the gentleman from Missouri, when it comes to the Club of Rome and today's Church of Climate, or the population bomb and peak oil doomsday predictions of the late 60s and 70s, and then rising sea levels and boiling temperatures predicted today, the history is outright repeating. And that brings us to our next connection. It's that history and how it rhymes, or in this case, how it repeats. Because much of the climate change complex, it's predicated on not just stopping growth, but outright reducing growth. Think about entities like the United Nations as an example of one of the loudest advocates, right, and the most vocal supporters for the Code Red for Humanity and the need to act decisively via state intervention when it comes to climate change. You take a look at the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, and I encourage you constant listeners to give them a read when you get a chance. You'll find that many of those goals, they're basically outright prescriptions to stop growth and actually to regress or reduce growth. An example of this is goal number 12 under those UN Sustainable Development Goals, which is the Responsible Consumption and Responsible Production Goal. So the first sentence on the UN website under goal 12 says, quote, "Achieving economic growth and sustainable development requires that we urgently reduce our ecological footprint by changing the way we produce and consume goods and resources," end quote. Now that sounds good, but that's all code for less, for pulling progress in, for holding growth back, and warranting that all of it is not just positive, but ethical. That's wrongheaded. Now, just like the wrongheaded themes that the Club of Rome and the Limits to Growth preached decades ago, the repeating of history, it's also evident in the vernacular and with the vocabulary. So sustainability, that first arrived on the scene as a key part of the lexicon with the Club of Rome and with its work products like the Limits to Growth. Today, sustainability dominates all discussion in business, in government, in academia. It has to be the most often used phrase on the UN website for sure. I mean, I haven't run the statistics, but I'm sure that would come up as the top ping. Like back then, everybody today talks about sustainability, but you know what? No one seems to be able to tangibly define it or measure it. It's odd that something that's so nebulous to define or measure is so prevalent across society. But that's how it goes when free markets are supplanted by ideology and when science is replaced with the religion. And of course, the ideology and the religion, they're going to be defined for us and decisions will be dictated to us by who? By the elite and by the expert class. And an underpinning of this philosophy, it's our next connection. Both then and now, there is the belief in the expert class that state intervention and bureaucratic wisdom, those things are superior to free markets and the individual and private sector innovation. That was a false premise then, and it's a big false premise now. Then it was proven false by the failure of communism and with stagflation in the 1970s in places like the United States, when our policies became more heavily influenced by state intervention. And it's a false premise now as we're learning with energy and climate policies, with loose monetary policy, and with government spending, all of which collectively create scarcity and remove abundance, that stoke inflation and erase affordability, that create geopolitical instability by enabling aggressors like Putin, where peace once existed, and that create a dynamic of fiscal math that can yield nothing other than breakage. And all these dots, they come together in perhaps what's going to serve as the linchpin connection of episode 80. I'll reference it as the trap of the anti-growth and the anti-free market ideology of the left. The sequencing of the trap, it's linear. So let's walk through it and recognize that each step we've discussed extensively in prior episodes of The Far Middle. So constant listeners are going to find much of this quite familiar, but perhaps see it interlinked for the first time. You'll see it in series. And we're going to start with the first step, which is a very basic but very important point to make, which is the philosophy of the left. It all begins there. And that is the belief and the conviction that the collective and the state and the expert class, they're much better suited to make decisions on behalf of the individual and the business and the society than the individual himself or herself are suited to make on their own behalf. Now, that belief, it's core to the sequencing we're about to discuss, and it indeed pervades everything that you see coming from the left, both in the past and in the present, as well as you can bet on in the future. And using this philosophy of the left, the first step in the sequence is a major policy of some sort that has the ability to impact just about everything of economic interest and with respect to value creation downstream of it. Now, the biggest, baddest example of this at play today is the slew of energy and climate policies being pushed by the left across developed nations and global organizations, such as that United Nations that we spoke about, or the IMF, World Bank, and so on. And once you have energy and climate policies in place, they're going to do exactly what they're designed to do. What is that? Well, it's basically aiming at creating energy scarcity. And these policies are becoming wildly successful at doing just that. When you don't build pipelines, that creates a scarcity of domestic oil or natural gas. When you don't allow hookups to homes for natural gas stoves and furnaces, that creates a scarcity of energy options for consumers. When the EU motivates or demands or incentivizes the shuttering in of domestic oil and natural gas fields, that creates energy scarcity that requires an answer. And in the case we're seeing today, that answer was Russia. And when policies subsidize and mandate a heavy reliance on unreliable and costly and inefficient at scale wind and solar, scarcity ensues in the forms of rolling blackouts and grid instability. So we've seen examples of this, right, all over the globe in the last number of years, where energy scarcity has reared its ugly head in places as far-ranging as Texas and California and Boston and Europe. And the examples, you know, they're going to continue to grow. You can count on it. Now, the next step in our sequence progression is that once you've instituted energy scarcity, energy inflation becomes a certainty. That will manifest in everything from the price of electricity to the price of gasoline for transportation to the price of any product that relies on energy as a necessary ingredient, which, by the way, is effectively anything and everything in a modern society. So what have we seen recently across economies these days? You've seen raging inflation when it comes to energy prices, and in Europe, in the energy-rich United States, and in everywhere in between. Short-term fixes that you're seeing to gloss over or to hide the problem, guess what? They're only going to make energy inflation worse over the long term. Now, once you have energy inflation, it's a certainty, an absolute certainty. It will quickly be followed by overall inflation. Why? Because once again, every imaginable product in a modern society requires, to some degree, energy as an input. If you raise the cost of the necessary input, then you're going to necessarily see an increase over time in the price of the subsequent derivative product. And indeed, today, we see inflation raging all across the planet and across every imaginable category. There's no end in sight, and chances are much greater that things are going to worsen before they moderate. Now, when you have overall inflation raging, that precipitates the next event, which is central banks having to raise interest rates. Why? Because as Milton Friedman taught us, inflation is always a function of monetary policy. So as we see today, the Federal Reserve and the ECB and the Bank of England, they're all in a race to see who can raise interest rates the furthest and the fastest. All this talk of a Fed pivot, at least in the current time frame, it's hogwash because central banks all over the world, they've got a lot more raising of rates to do before they can even begin to think about moderating interest rates. And when interest rates are raised by central banks, what is a natural byproduct? Well, if nations are carrying huge loads of national debt, then there should be expected to be a dramatic increase in the debt-carrying interest expense of government budgets. Lo and behold, the United States is sitting on a $30-plus trillion debt pile, which is over 120% of GDP, and with a higher interest rate environment, the debt load requires higher interest expense paid each year by the federal government to service that debt. And when the debt servicing costs of the government skyrockets because of higher interest rates, that's going to result in one of three things, or worse yet, a combination of all three. First possible outcome is that the deficit grows even larger because of the higher debt servicing costs. A second possible outcome is if deficits are not allowed to grow further, then taxes have to be raised. The third possible outcome is holding deficits flat and then spending by government must be reined in. And here I mean specifically discretionary spending, right? Because you've got to pay the interest expense on the debt. That's non-discretionary. Now, out of those three possible outcomes, right, raising taxes or reining in spending or allowing the deficit to grow even further, which do you think might occur, constant listeners? Do you see Congress raising taxes or reining in spending, or do you see them growing the deficit even further? This, in a nutshell, this is the trap of a no-growth approach and of state intervention and of heavy-handed policies that are embraced by the left. We're experiencing the sequencing of follow-on events as we speak, and these symptoms are popping up worldwide. And if the elite and expert class insist that the medicine for these symptoms is to double down on what's causing the illness in the first place, then it's obvious that things are going to get worse quickly and in an accelerated manner. So to the point where things, as in government budgets and central bank credibility and capital markets and societies in general, to the point where they actually break. This is heavy stuff, big consequences, but a simple sequence and logic train when you think it through. Okay, before we close out episode 80, I do want to mention and to promote an event that I'll be at actually this week at Marietta College in Ohio. I'll be speaking to students and faculty in the business program as well as leaders of the university. I'll be lecturing at a petroleum engineering class to prospective graduates in that profession, and I'll be giving a keynote speech to the Economic Roundtable of the Ohio Valley. I'm really looking forward to all that. I'm very excited about it, and we will dedicate episode 81 next week to reviewing some of the themes that that we discussed and some of the observations that I had and a sense of where students and faculty and business leaders in the Ohio Valley, where their collective heads are these days. So I'm hoping that you constant listeners are looking forward to that as well when it's covered in episode 81 in a week. Now, let's do a proper closeout for episode 80. It's early December, as we discussed at the start, and we've talked about how ill-advised policies from the elite and the expert classes, whether it be the Club of Rome variety from the past or the United Nations of today, or those in politics advocating for these types of energy or climate policies tomorrow that you're seeing more and more of, they've all created a situation for society and for economies where we're checking in, but we can't check out. And that somewhat borrowed phrase, it brings me to the topic of the December 1976 release of one of the most successful rock albums of all time, as in over 17 million copies sold. That album was the epic from the Eagles titled Hotel California. Yeah, one of the most famous lines in rock history is from the title song of the album, which is, you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. Seems increasingly and unfortunately that that is the case when it comes to where our national debt rises to, where our economic growth is falling to, and where our energy security is heading. Now, the album cover photo for Hotel California is an iconic shot of the Beverly Hills Hotel at sunset, located in Los Angeles, of course. And by the way, the album Hotel California, by the California band The Eagles, guess what? It wasn't recorded in California. Instead, it was recorded in Miami. And most people who like the Eagles and that album will point to Hotel California, the title track, New Kid in Town, and Life in the Fast Lane as their favorite songs on the album. And I certainly won't argue with those choices. They're all excellent singles. But my favorite from Hotel California is not one of those three, but instead it's the often ignored gem of Pretty Maids All in a Row, which is sung not by Don Henley and not by Glenn Frey, but by the eccentric genius that is Joe Walsh. Give it a listen if you haven't recently. Now, instead of Pretty Maids all lined in a row, we now have 80 Farm Middle episodes lined in a row, and we will make it 81 next week. Till then, you stay safe and stay positive.